The German people fund ARD and ZDF to the tune of $9 billion per year. $9 billion. It's required to put your content on YouTube. If you're going to take that much money out of the public ecosystem, then you should pay it back by providing truth and professional reporting to the public in return for the money you're getting out of their taxes.
Echte Insights aus der Medienbranche. Hier sind deine Innovation Minutes, direkt aus dem Media Lab Bayern.
Hallo bei den Innovation Minutes. Ich bin's, deine Host, wie gewohnt, Sabrina Harper. Und die nächsten 30 Minuten geht's um die Nutzerinnen und Nutzer von Medien und wie die Medienbranche mit dem Ansatz des User-Centric umgehen und sich weiterentwickeln kann. Dazu habe ich mir einen Gast aus den USA geholt, der sich insbesondere beim Streaming versus traditionelles Fernsehen auskennt und heutzutage ein internationaler Experte ist. Vielleicht hast du die Stimme auch schon erkannt. Es ist Evan Shapiro aus New York. Er ist Produzent, er war schon für den Emmy nominiert. Er unterrichtet, berät und beschäftigt sich viel mit der Zukunft in der Bewegtbildbranche, wie es so schön heißt. Ich habe Evan das erste Mal letztes Jahr in den USA getroffen und diesen Herbst haben sich unsere Wege wieder gekreuzt, als er aus Versehen bei mir ins Podcaststudio gestolpert ist. Und da haben wir gesagt, wir müssten jetzt mal zusammen quatschen. Und was soll ich sagen? Here we are. Welcome, Evan Shapiro. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Let's start directly because we only have 29 minutes left and we are talking about user centricity and what role it plays in the future. But let's start in the now and here. And user centricity is something that's in the media landscape today, especially for broadcasters and streaming platforms. Why is it so important?
The last era of media was defined by RCA's tagline, his master's voice. So it's a very top-down, push-oriented ecosystem dictated by what the gatekeeper's taste told them. And then the consumer was kind of forced to deal with what came out the other side. In this new era, since technology has given the power over curation to the consumer, the gatekeeper doesn't have a choice but to bend to the wishes of their audiences. And when you look at the churn rate of streaming services, when you look at, over the last couple of years, consumers have started to cut back since the end of COVID on the amount of content they're consuming on a regular basis, which includes social media, audio, and video down to, what they consider the bare necessities, meaning the services that they're using at any given moment versus the services that they have but aren't using that at that time. The corporations that run the corporate media industrial complex really do need to start to reorient themselves around the lives and wishes of their consumers or lose those consumers to the platforms that will. And importantly, that means losing them to the creator economy platforms, such as YouTube and TikTok and Instagram, where the consumer has the ability to basically change channels at a whim. And I think, you're seeing the crisis in the corporate media community with regards to, Comcast spinning out its cable networks and Warner Brothers Discovery, Disco Brothers reorganizing their corporate construct around, this new media reality. Comcast writing down the value of Sky by $9 billion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you're watching what happens when these corporate media giants do not change their operations to meet the moment.
But how do they know what people want? There are some figures, of course, and there's those called personas. They are really superficial and the personas aren't that close to reality as they should be. Maybe. What do you think? Am I wrong or do broadcasters just doing something what is not real, thinking that people want this stuff, but they don't?
I think it's not hard to determine what audiences want. I think the hardest part is keeping track of it on a minute-to-minute basis. And I think that's what's become incredibly difficult for the corporate media giants is they're not, you know, when you look at the Disneys, you look at the Warner Brothers Discoveries, you look at the BBCs, you look at the ZDFs and the ARDs, they're not as used to incorporating the data flow into their operations. You know, they're used to kind of old school diary-based data tracking that kind of gives them broad pictures of what the audiences want, as opposed to, you know, big tech like Amazon and Apple, Microsoft and Google, who read their data on a minute-by-minute basis and adapt and adjust in real time to a certain extent to meet the audiences in the mindset that they want. Here's a great example for you. I've written a lot recently about how much usage YouTube gets on television and how big media really needs to stop focusing on competing with each other and concentrating on YouTube both as a major competitor on TV and as a potential broadcast partner at the same time. And I say that and I'll say things like, you know, YouTube is now the number one channel on television. Data just came out recently that showed that 1 billion hours of YouTube per day is being watched on TV, not on phones. There's a whole other set of content that's being watched there, but 1 billion hours a day of YouTube on TV is being consumed. And I'll say that to professionals in the industry and they'll go, no, that's not right.
I can imagine that. But I guess younger people, they watch a lot of YouTube, maybe on TV.
I think that's a generational overstatement. When you really push people about YouTube on TV, it's in every person. It's younger people watch more than older people. But when you just ask anybody who has a child under the age of 10 in the home, they watch a lot of YouTube on TV. But look at 20 Days in Mariupol, which is the Academy Award winner last year for best documentary. Substantially, like 10 times more people have watched that entire film on YouTube than watched it on PBS. More people watch SNL on YouTube than watch it on TV. And then you go into things like YouTube says that 400 million hours a month of podcasts are watched on TV. Well, who's doing that? That's not teenagers who are doing that. I mean, some teenagers maybe, but podcasts are an every person type of content. And so, you tell people about this data and it's as if, you know, frankly, they act as if I'm making it up. And they say that's a young person's thing. Well, even if it is a young, I released a study recently with Barb in the UK that showed over 35, people were still watching BBC and Channel 4 and ITV through their apps and on broadcast, but that under 35, nobody was watching the public service broadcasters. And the pushback I got from professionals, adult professionals in the UK in the television industry was disconcerting. It was, you know, there is a fear of finding out in our industry now that allows people to ignore the data that's staring them in the face. And it's, you know, A, it's good for my business because that's kind of what I write about. So I'll take it. But on the other hand, it's really mind-boggling how purposely ignorant people will hold themselves in order to protect the things they think are true.
Okay. The first thing that comes to my mind is, isn't it dangerous to give so much power to YouTube when you are a broadcaster? Because if I think about the recent weeks and where Meta is shifting and what was going on with X and stuff, so isn't it dangerous to collaborate with YouTube because you don't have the power about what YouTube's gonna do with your content?
I would make the same argument about Comcast.
Okay.
And ProSieben. And Scott.
Yes.
And I mean, go down the long list. You know, corporate assholes are going to be corporate assholes. Why is YouTube any worse as a broadcasting partner? And in the case of YouTube, unlike Comcast and Sky and ProSieben, they don't make content. So they're not really in competition with you in the same way that some of these other collaborators are. Like, why is Samsung okay, but YouTube isn't? That doesn't compute in my mind. I understand the fear of YouTube because they are so massive. They're one of the most valuable companies in the history of humankind. And they have such a massive install base with people under the age of 35. But on the other hand, while for a news organization, let's say, if you are avoiding working, putting your news up on YouTube, in the case, let's take the BBC or Channel 4 or ZDF or ARD, if you're saying like, we don't want to put our content there because it's not premium and it gives them too much power, well, then you're just ceding these platforms to the bad actors, to the people who would, you know, abuse information and truth as a business practice. And I think that is specifically as it pertains to the public service media, I think it's an abdication of their, you know, their mission and their mandate. You know, they're there to serve all Germans. ZDF and ARD are there to serve all German citizens. And their avoidance, and I will say ZDF really leans into YouTube in a big way. I can't really speak for ARD as much, but I don't know that they put their news live while it's on TV on YouTube. They should. Why? Look at the elections in East Germany of late. That's why, right there. Like, misinformation is now outrunning the truth on these platforms. And one of the reasons for that is public service media and news organizations are not embracing these social media platforms in the way that they need to pull younger people into the conversation.
Okay, I get your point. So if I get it right, you say they have to be there because there are so much people. And if they are doing news for everyone in Germany, they should also feed social media platforms like YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, not distributing your content on YouTube or Instagram or TikTok is kind of like saying, well, I don't want to put my beans in Tesco because I don't like Tesco. Well, okay, who's that hurting?
Okay.
Who is that hurting?
No, I got you, because it's a big decision in Germany, where to go and where not to go. So I have to ask this.
Yeah, and Germans, by the way, the German people fund ARD and ZDF to the tune of $9 billion per year. $9 billion. It's required, I would argue, to put your content on YouTube. If you're going to take that much money out of the public ecosystem, then you should pay it back by providing truth and professional reporting specifically, but also sports and entertainment to the public in return for the money you're getting out of their taxes.
Okay, let's get back to user centricity. Another point that I want to talk about is a brand identity, because I was thinking, if I do everything for my users, maybe I'm losing myself as a company, my values, where I want to go, what I do. Do you think there's a danger for losing credibility or brand identity? For example, if everybody likes the color green and I do everything in green, and 1 year later, everyone likes blue and I do everything in blue, people could say, you're not real. You know what I mean?
I think, look, you do want to remain authentic to the things that are important to you. But on the other hand, part of what we do as content creators is meant to serve a public who likes our stuff. And so, you know, I think one of the misperceptions about the shift in technology and media over the last decade is that you have to get to massive scale and have 100 million subscribers in order to be successful. I don't believe that's true. And in fact, one would argue that hyper-serving the most passionate community, the niche that loves your content best, will ultimately serve you and them at the same time. And so I would argue, make your content, find out who loves it, and then build your economic model around that size of audience, as opposed to simply trying to check every box for every constituency out there. You know, I have, you know, about 50,000, a little over 50,000 followers on LinkedIn. It may seem like a big number, but it's not. I mean, when you look at Mr. Beast has 100 million subscribers and I have 50,000, and I have 15,000 subscribers on my newsletter. So I'm hyper serving a very particular band of folks. But if what I'm writing for them starts to curve off of what they expect, well, then they're going to abandon me. And so, you know, to a certain extent, we do need to serve the audiences that sustain us. And, you know, losing your authenticity happens, I think, when you try to reach scale for scale's sake, as opposed to creating a passionate relationship between you and your community. The main tenet of user centricity, the user centric era, is the idea that it's not about scale, it's about passion. It's not about audience, it's about community. And so the idea that the relationship between the publisher or the creator and the community that loves them is the thing to keep sacrosanct. That's a contract between you and the people who love what you do. I think as long as you keep that central and you're not chasing scale for scale's sake, I think it's hard to lose sight of your authentic self unless you abandon it all just to kind of make money. And then that's a whole, you know, companies should have a mandate other than making money. That's, making money is not a mission. Making something great that earns you money is a mission.
Sounds great to me, but doesn't seem to be working in reality. If you're a big broadcaster, I think passion goes and money comes and maybe you're losing credibility.
I don't know. I mean, ITV made really made the biggest hit in the UK last year, Mr. Bates in the Post Office. And it captured the entire country's attention over the course of 10 weeks. Then they make other stuff that isn't as popular. I think there are lots of examples out there. Traders is another one that really captured the public's attention. You know, the broadcasters all put FIFA on in the EU and, you know, business stops when the games are on. So, or the matches, apologies. So I disagree. I think the problem with broadcasters is they went from a model where it was feasible to try to please everyone to an era where pleasing everyone is a lot less possible. And that's the issue they're having. Not they can't find the right size constituency. It's that they can't adjust their model to meet the time.
Okay, got you. So we are talking about traditional media stuff and the way it evolved to 2025, I would say. If we take a look in the future, what do you think in like 5 or 10 years, what will be user centricity about? Do we all have a device that tells us what's next and they have more data? Or
we have those devices. They're called iPhones and smartphones.
Okay, maybe we got more devices or more specific devices. I don't know. If I feel sad, they will show me a drama. And if I have fun, they will show me an action movie or I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's the thing that's going to happen without question. And then there's the thing that ought to happen. And if it doesn't, it'll come with dangers for mainstream media. So the thing that's going to happen.
Tell me more.
Yeah. So the thing that is going to happen is that we're going to look back on last fall as the moment when the creator economy took over the center of cultural relevance from mainstream media around the globe. The election here, the Jake Paul fight, you can look at it, the elections in Germany, the elections in the UK. These are all examples of the signs of the shift last year. And so that shift of power and attention and finance will continue to move from mainstream media into the creator economy. And there are tons of different reasons for that. But most notably, everything I just said earlier, which is we're moving from an era of pure scale to one of pure passion. So there's no more powerful relationship than between a community and the creators that they love. So that's thing number one. The thing that ought to happen, and that if it doesn't, is a real danger for mainstream media, is mainstream media needs to understand that it's not a battle amongst themselves. It's a battle between big media and big tech. And if big media, including public service media and commercial media, does not learn how to collaborate better, specifically around data, so that when Sabrina logs on, the television set will tell her, hey, we see these are your subscriptions that you currently have, or these are the services that you currently have. Here are the 5 or 6 shows on all these platforms that you're going to like today. Right now, the technology can't do that, not because the tech isn't there, but because the providers of the content refuse to work together. It's all a zero-sum game of, it's not enough that I win, all others must lose, and my data is mine, it's my precious, it's the ring I must protect. And as a consequence, the platforms and the devices can't possibly serve the users as well as they should, because all of these walled gardens are prohibiting the information from being shared. I don't know what subscriptions you have, and therefore I can't tell you where the content you're going to watch today is going to be. Discovery has become the existential crisis of the content economy. People can't find things to watch and listen to because the platforms do not talk to each other in the way that they should. It's not like the internet. It's still like broadcast television.
If you say if everyone shares their information, how do you avoid that people are not staying in a so-called bubble because they are just consuming what they have subscriptions for?
I think that's the answer to it. I think the reason why people are getting more and more isolated and the content bubbles are getting thicker is because I can't find something new to watch, so I'm just going to give up and watch the same thing. I ask this of audiences all the time. Have you ever logged on to a streaming service, couldn't find something to watch, logged on to another streaming service, couldn't find something to watch, logged on to another streaming service, couldn't find something to watch, gave up, smoked a joint, just watched Friends?
That's true.
That's a failure of data collaboration. That's not a failure of the mechanisms. That's not a failure of the devices. That's a failure of the ecosystem and the navigation allows itself. That is our own fault. That is not the fault of the devices. That is not the fault of the technology. That's the fault of the publishers.
That was an interesting talk at the South by Southwest that one guy from Netflix said that they have produced less movies, but they had more streaming time. And he was thinking about maybe that's the problem because people can't find stuff. They watch less. And if they can find stuff, they stay tuned. So maybe it's too much stuff.
And what's happening there, and this has come out recently, is that a lot of the stuff that's being watched over those hours and hours and hours on Netflix is just on in the background. So it's not even really being watched. It's, you know, it's noise by which I do my laundry to or cook my dinner to. And, you know, A, that's not terrible. I've done that for 100 years. But then secondarily, there's a real detriment to the ecosystem when everything just becomes background noise and nothing is gaining the attention. You know, Netflix won't talk about this, but their view time is flattening everywhere across the world. In the UK, it's actually declining. In the US, it's flattened. And you look at the distance. I put out a slide recently that demonstrates this. If you look at the distance between YouTube's engagement and Netflix engagement, it's widening. It's not narrowing. And the reason is YouTube knows what I want to watch and it steers me in the way to discover new things that are like that thing I want to watch. It's not all confirmation bias. It allows for a greater level of discovery than any other premium platform does. And, you know, that's a lesson right there. Netflix, if you're out of things to watch on Netflix, Netflix should tell you to go watch Apple TV Plus. I know that sounds antithetical to the way competition works, but it'll make me happier as a consumer. And therefore, I'm more likely to go back to Netflix as a result of that. Now, Netflix is not having a churn problem yet. But I think it's only a matter of time when that frustration bubbles up to create a backlash from consumers, especially as they raise their prices and crack down on password sharing.
Okay, I want to talk about another point that you mentioned. You mentioned collaborations between broadcasters and big tech. So is collaboration the only way to survive as a broadcaster, or do you see something else that broadcasters can make it on their own, or is there any other solution?
There is no other solution.
Just no.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like saying, well, can cars survive without roads?
If they can fly,
no,
maybe.
All right, but then they're not cars anymore, they're planes. And even then, without in the United States, it's the FAA. I wouldn't know what the German equivalent of that is. But without the governmental organizations to make sure planes don't crash into each other, then no, planes can't fly. And so publishers can no more survive without big tech than cars can survive without roads. People can't survive without, I know this is going to sound crazy to certain people in the world, but people can't survive without governments. You know, they provide us the infrastructure we need to be safe. There's a reason why the lives of humans are lengthening. It's not because we're getting stronger. It's because we're creating better health services and better policies that protect the people of the earth. And what's happening is the broadcasters think it's a battle against big tech as opposed to, hey, big tech is the facilitation device to reach our consumers. And no, if you're not prepared to collaborate with Amazon and Google and Apple and Meta and Microsoft, no, you're going to get smaller and smaller and smaller until you become irrelevant. And then the public's not going to want to fund public service media, and the consumers are not going to want to subscribe to your service.
So broadcasters can survive without big tech, but big tech can survive without broadcasters.
No, that's the thing, is that that's where I think the broadcasting and publishing community doesn't understand, is big tech needs quality publishers as much as the quality publishers needs big tech. It is a symbiotic relationship. You just have to enter it as such. You know, you can't think about everybody as the enemy and then figure out a way to work with everyone at the same time. So no, it is not. We have to leave binary choices behind. This is a much more complicated world than it used to be. And nuance is substantially more important now than it ever has been. Again, that's not something that's going to be popular with the polemic right wing of the ecosystem, but it is true. We all have to learn how to get along. Well, a friend of mine quotes Benjamin Franklin all the time, who said, you know, we need to hang together or surely we will hang apart. And that's exactly where we are. The consumer wants it all to act as one thing. They don't want fragmentation. They want to be able to pick up this device and get everything that they need all of the time. We, as an ecosystem and as a community, need to provide that to them, or, you know, we will be punished as a result of that.
So do you have any advice how people or broadcasters should step into that game? Is there like the first three steps they should do to be more prepared for working with big tech companies?
I think you have to zoom back out and say, I need to be prepared to serve my audience. I need to be prepared to serve a community. So thing number one is understand who that community is and what they want. Read the data that's staring you right in the face. The second is the world's population is now almost two-thirds under the age of 40. And the people under the age of 40 are more diverse than any population the planet Earth has ever seen. They're more complicated. They're harder to read.
Complex.
They're complex.
Let's call it complex.
Yeah, they are complex because they are diverse. And they can hold two thoughts in their head at the same time. And so if you're trying to run a publishing organization or a media organization without including people under the age of 40 or under the age of 35 in the room when you make these decisions, if you were trying to make decisions about your company without people in the room who grew up too poor to buy your product, you're screwed. So start including more voices in the room who come from the communities you're looking to serve. Make your executive organizational decision tree look like the community you're trying to serve. If you do not do that, you're going to lose to those who do that. Yeah, I think crucially, it's a culture change. It's not a business model change. We are in a brand new world, and we still have companies and organizations in big media who continue to act as if it's, you know, 2002 or 1998. And that's not going to work anymore.
Thank you, Ivan, for having those insights. Everyone who wants to know more, I will put the link to your newsletter into the show notes. Thanks for your time and sharing your thoughts.
Thanks so much. It was great to talk to you.
Und wie geht's dir mit dem Ansatz der Zentrierung auf Nutzer und Nutzerinnen bei den Produkten und wie wir heutzutage Fernsehen, Streaming, Bewegtbild, aber auch andere Medien machen? Stimmst du zu oder bist du dagegen? Lass mir gern einen Kommentar da, zum Beispiel auf Spotify, oder melde dich per Mail. Das war's für heute mit den Innovation Minutes. Mein Name ist Sabrina Harper. Und wenn du magst, hören wir uns ganz bald wieder. Einfach diesem Podcast folgen und keine Folge mehr verpassen. Bis bald.
Das waren deine Innovation Minutes. Direkt aus dem Media Lab Bayern. Du willst mehr? Dann besuche uns auf media-lab.de und starte dein eigenes Projekt.
Last but not least.
Dieser Podcast ist möglich, weil wir tolle Unterstützer und Unterstützerinnen haben. Besonderer Dank geht an die Staatskanzlei Bayern, die Bayerische Landeszentrale für neue Medien, BLM, und natürlich an meine Kollegen und Kolleginnen in der Medien Bayern.